All right, go with me this morning to Revelation, the last book of your New Testament, and to chapter 4. Revelation chapter 4. Good to see you all. I understand that you have a break coming up. Anybody know how many days? Six? Too many. Well, in just a few days, you are going to have a Thanksgiving break, and perhaps some of you will venture out to snag some shopping deals. Maybe some of you will get up early on Friday morning, insanely early, to participate in Black Friday. Or as the trend is becoming, now you'll have to go out Thursday afternoon to Walmart and get all your Christmas shopping done then. You know, these stores work really hard to grab your attention. They put up these displays, and they arrange the merchandise in such a way that what is front and center is supposed to capture your attention and cause you to want to purchase that particular thing. There's a lot of effort. There's a lot of thought. There's a lot of design that goes into those displays. And what I want to ask you this morning is the question, do we ever give significant thought to what our lives put on display? Do we consider the design of our life, the arrangement of our life, the way things are organized, and consider what people are actually confronted with when they see us, when they see our lifestyle? What are they immediately attracted to? Well, the answer to the question, what or who should be on display in our lives, is found in the text that I had you turn to, Revelation chapter 4. And we're going to get a glimpse of heaven in this chapter. And this vision of heaven is going to give us proper perspective and answer that question. What should be on display? What should be front and center in a believer's life? When John is given a vision of heaven, what's the first thing he sees? Look at verse 2. And it's interesting to note that John doesn't see what many people who have had near-death experiences say that they saw in heaven. So he doesn't see saints floating around on clouds, strumming on harps. He doesn't see people sitting in easels, painting. He doesn't see a large screen where people are watching their lives and reviewing their lives. Rather, John recounts, and immediately I was in the Spirit, and behold, what does it say? A throne. And not an empty throne, not an abandoned throne. John records that there was one who sat on the throne. But why is John's attention immediately drawn to the throne and the one seated on it? It's because this enthroned person is at the very center of heaven's arrangement. And this isn't an accident. For example, I've never taken a class in interior design, but I understand that they teach you that every room should have a focal point around which the furniture in that particular room revolves. So, for example, you might walk into a living room and see a fireplace, and there's a beautiful painting over the fireplace, and that becomes the focal point when you walk into that room. So now we've got our focal point. Listen to the words of one well-known interior designer. She says, quote, "Once a focal point has been established, the furnishings should be arranged in a fashion," and these are her words, "exalting it." That is, exalting the focal point. In other words, she says, when you're sitting in this room, your eyes should naturally and comfortably be looking at this important part of the room. And guess what? The interior design of heaven is no different. Heaven is so arranged that its focal point is the enthroned God. And everything else, all the furniture in heaven, as it were, points our attention to him, this important part of the room. And I think that design is apparent just by looking at the text itself. Look at verse 3, for example. Notice that everything else John sees in heaven is described in terms of its location and orientation to the center, to the throne, and the one sitting on it. The middle of verse 3 states that there was a rainbow round about the throne. So encircling the throne, you've got a rainbow. Verse 4, and round about the throne were 24 seats or thrones, and upon the seats 24 elders sitting. So now you've got a rainbow and 24 elders sitting on 24 thrones encircling the centerpiece, the throne of God. Verse 5, out of the throne, or from the throne, proceed lightnings and thunderings and voices. And middle of verse 5 tells us there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne. And verse 6, before the throne, there was a sea of glass. And notice the rest of verse 6, in the midst or the center of the throne or round about the throne were four beasts. And I think when it says in the midst of the throne, it probably means that there's one on either side of the throne. Then verse 9, the four beasts or living creatures give glory and honor and thanks. And notice where they direct their praise. Same focal point, right? To him that sat on the throne. And finally, verse 10, the 24 elders fall down before him that sat on the throne, and they worship him and cast their crowns before the throne. So you don't have to understand the meaning of every little detail in this passage to understand this, that the focal point of heaven is the enthroned God. And what I'd like to argue is that this arrangement, this design of heaven is to have some correspondence down here on earth. Remember when Jesus taught his disciples to pray. And he said, pray this way, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done. There's that idea of authority or governance. Thy will be done where? On earth, just as it is in heaven. You see, you hear the correspondence there? Your will be done on earth just as it is in heaven. Whatever is done on earth is supposed to reflect and mirror the arrangement of things in heaven. So what I'd like to do really for the majority of the message this morning is just to ask this question. To what degree does my life correspond to the arrangement of heaven? Or another way to ask this would be, to what extent is my life centered on God? And not just on God in general, but on the enthroned God in particular. So when somebody looks at the various aspects of my life, is their attention immediately drawn to God on the throne? So let me ask you some questions, some applicational questions to really flesh this out. Is the enthroned God at the center of my religious activity? Is the enthroned God at the center of my religious activity? And I'm starting with religious activity because you may not think that this would be a problem in religious activity, but it is. It's very easy to put self at the center of even the best activities. And keep in mind, if God is not the center, then something else is. And the most natural, native replacement for God is ourselves. It's like the Pharisees who prayed. Good thing in and of itself, religious activity. But they prayed so that they would be seen of men. There's a selfish motivation. So in some cases, it's not overt. It's not what you're seeing on the outside. It's actually the heart posture. It's the heart motivation for why we're doing what we're doing. Would you hold a finger in Revelation 4, turn over with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And I want to look at a positive example, and then we'll look at a negative example of having God at the center of our religious life. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. And look with me at verse 11. Paul, writing to the church at Corinth, says that it has been declared unto me of you, my brethren, by them which are of the house of Chloe, that there are contentions among you. There were divisions. And one of the problems that this particular church had was selfishness, self-promotion, self-display. And that was expressing itself in this divisiveness. Now this I say, verse 12, that every one of you saith, I am of Paul, and I am of Apollos, and I am of Cephas, and I am of Christ. So they're rallying around particular personalities. You have these personality parties. And verse 14, I thank God, he says, verse 13, is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I baptized none of you but Crispus and Gaius, lest any should say that I had baptized in my own name. And I baptized also the household of Stephanas besides. I know not whether I baptized any other. For Christ sent me not to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom of words, lest the cross of Christ should be made of none effect. So do you get the spirit of the Apostle Paul? Why is he glad he didn't baptize them? Because he didn't want anybody rallying around him as the focal point. And he says, even in my preaching, I was careful not to use enticing words of man's wisdom, lest the cross of Christ, this other focal point, be nullified, be emptied of its power. In other words, I'm going to bend over backwards to make sure God is at the center. And that when you look at me, whether it's baptizing or preaching, I want God to be glorified. And that's why he says in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 31, say this verse with me, whether therefore ye eat or drink or whatsoever ye do, do all to the glory of God. And that includes baptizing and that includes preaching. I mean, even right now as I preach to you, I have this struggle that I've got to overcome, that this not be about me. This is not about me. My endeavor has to be to set forward God enthroned, Jesus Christ crucified. Now, in contrast to this, look at 3 John chapter 9. Contrast to Paul's example, look at 3 John chapter 9. Paul says that I wrote unto the church, but Diotrephes, who loveth to have the preeminence, he loves to be first, receiveth us not. So this guy was so stringent in his circle of fellowship that even the Apostle John didn't get into it. This guy controlled the circle of fellowship, and even the apostle was not received. Wherefore, he says, verse 10, if I come, I will remember his deeds, which he doeth, prating against us with malicious words, and not content therewith, neither doth he himself receive the brethren, and forbiddeth them that would, and casteth them out of the church. So even as something as someone's attempt or endeavor to guard the church and to guard the purity of the church and the doctrine of the church could be driven by a desire for preeminence. It could be rooted in selfishness, a desire to have control, to draw the circle, and you control the circle and who gets in and who stays out. You have a similar a negative example in Galatians chapter 2, if you'll turn there with me. Galatians chapter 2. Where you have Paul having to confront the apostle Peter. You see that in verse 11. But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face because he was guilty. He was to be blamed. For before that certain came from James, probably the reference to the Judaizers who taught that salvation was by faith and circumcision, he did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, notice, fearing them which were of the circumcision. And the other Jews dissembled likewise with him, insomuch that Barnabas also was carried away with their dissimulation or their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they walked not uprightly according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter before them all, if thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of the Gentiles and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews? So you got Peter, who is being driven by self-protection. a fear of the Judaizers, these certain men from James, and as a result is actually distancing himself from those who are true believers, these Gentile converts. So selfishness, self-centeredness comes into play even in the religious sphere. And the problem that Paul says, the big problem with Peter's activity here is that the truth of the gospel was not front and center. That's the issue. So is God at the center of our religious life? Secondly, is God at the center of my relationships? Is God at the center of my relationships? Is he at the center of your relationships with others in the residence halls? You know, sometimes you see just overt, obnoxious displays of selfishness. One of the most remarkable instances of this that I remember when I was on staff with the Dean of Men's Office working in the residence halls was a guy that had come home from a dating outing. I think I've shared this here before, but he came home from a dating outing, and evidently the gift for the evening was a bag of goldfish. And so he came in his room, and he put the goldfish where anybody put the goldfish, in the sink, and promptly picked up the phone and called his girlfriend, whom he just spent the whole night with, and they're talking on. And his roommate comes in the room, and he needs to brush his teeth. So he's trying to get a hold of his roommate's attention, who's on the phone, and the guy's just ignoring him. He's just kind of brushing him off. You know, there's very few things you can do that are worse than just ignoring somebody. So the guy gets ticked, and he grabs the bag of goldfish, and he opens up the window, and he chucks them out the window. Well, the guy on the phone was horrified and promptly grabbed the other guy's Sunday sack lunch and threw it out the window. And then you had this barrage of stuff from the dorm just going out the window. Finally, somebody walking along the sidewalk sees this stuff coming out the window and goes and reports it. Okay, and you want to go up to these guys and like, okay, guys, pause. You know, let's rewind this. Let's replay this and say, okay, now, at what point in this do you see God on display? Right? Okay, where is Jesus in this? Because I'm not seeing it. It's a display of self. And, you know, sometimes it's overt like that. Sometimes it's more subtle. It's just a, in fact, sometimes it comes across in very righteous dress. Like pretending to be something that you're really not, because you don't want people to know that you struggle. You're self-oriented in that way. And so there's a lack of transparency, and there's a lack of honesty, and there's a lack of genuineness. Why do you pray the way you do in prayer group? Is it to put God at the center, or is it to put you at the center? What is your relationship with your girlfriend or boyfriend? And can it be said, if somebody were to come into that relationship, so to speak, would they see the enthroned God at the center of that relationship? Or would they see two people absolutely, entirely preoccupied with one another? Would they see a guy who is possessive, who is abusive, who is domineering, who is manipulative, because he, like Diotrephes, wants to have control over the relationship? And by the way, girls, if the guy you're dating thinks highly of himself, get out now, that's all I can say. It'll just get worse. And in that relationship, are you thinking primarily in terms of what do I like about this person? What can I get out of this relationship? Or are you thinking to yourself, how can I put God on display in this relationship? How can I be the kind of person that I should be for that other person? And to show them Christ's love. So you come together as a couple for the purpose of putting God on display and not your own infatuation with each other. What is your relationship with your spiritual authorities? Can it be said that the enthroned, the ruling, governing God is at the center of your relationship with your spiritual authorities? And I know I wrestled with this, especially in high school, and still do to this point. There was a time when I was in high school and I just got fed up with people telling me what to do. I went to a public school and pretty much every weekend there was some kind of party, and I never got to go to the party, and I always had to blame it on my parents because they said I couldn't go. And there was this really pretty girl in my art club class who handed me a slip of paper with her number on it and said that she was inviting me to the party this weekend. I knew, you know, what was going to take place at the party, and I knew I shouldn't go, but I was tired of just living underneath the authority of my pastor, the authority of my family. And I remember I was bow hunting, and I was sitting up in my tree stand waiting for a deer to come by, and I just started getting upset in my spirit, and I said, you know what, I'm going to go down to the house, and I'm going to call that girl. And so I got down on my tree stand, I booked it down the hill, I went into my parents' bedroom, I picked up the phone, I dialed that number, and it was busy. And I remember thinking to myself, at that point, the thought crossed my mind that I just about destroyed myself because I was being self-exertive. I was doing what I wanted to do, and God was gracious and God was merciful to keep me from that. What is your relationship to your spiritual authorities? Is the enthroned God at the center of your financial decisions and my financial decisions? When you get a sum of money, which I know you guys never do, but let's say hypothetically you would get some extra money. Is God ruling over that, or is that my money to do what I want to do with it? Do my choices about what to spend my money on revolve around God, His will, His priority, His glory, His pleasure? I've been really convicted about that recently, that this money is the Lord's, to be used for His kingdom, His purposes, His mission. How about this? Is the enthroned God at the center of my life decisions and plans for my career and the future? Do my ambitions, do my goals, do my dreams come out from the throne, as it were? Is God the focal point in my decision to do what I've chosen to do with my life? When I was in high school and considering college, I was primarily thinking in terms of what do I like to do and what would make me the most bucks. And so because I love sports, I thought maybe sports medicine, maybe physical therapy, and I was thinking in terms of triple digits, at least $100,000 a year, and so what can I major in that will get me what I want in those terms? That was primarily what motivated me to major in pre-physical therapy. Now, I got down here and realized that's not what I wanted to major in, so I thought, what else do I like to do? Well, I like to play video games when I was in high school, so maybe computer science, okay? Well, computer science isn't playing video games, just in case you're wondering. It's programming, and it's a lot of complicated code, and I would spend all day Saturday in the lab looking for misplaced semicolons, and I'm thinking, I don't want to do this. Now, it really wasn't until I got into the prayer room in the residence hall and I finally said, Lord, I will do whatever you want me to do. God on the throne. It wasn't until that point that I really had a sense of direction from the Lord. Now, if you're majoring in pre-physical therapy or computer science, that's fine. The point is not that those majors are bad. The point is, why are you doing what you're doing? And is God governing that decision, that desire, those ambitions, those career goals? When it came to joining a society, I joined on the basis of, you know, who had the best sports team, and believe it or not, what the colors were. I like black and silver because I was an Oakland Raiders fan, and I know being a Christian, a Raiders fan is, you know, a little bit incongruous. I'm not anymore. I've since repented, but I chose my society based on the colors. They were black and silver, and I thought that was cool. You know, where was God in all of this? You know, if somebody were really coming into the room of my decision-making and saying, what's front and center? Well, it certainly wouldn't have been God. It wouldn't have been Christ. It wouldn't have been the gospel. Let me ask you this. Is God enthroned at the center of your academics? You know, you may work really hard, and good grades are important to you, and that's great, But why are you studying so hard? Why do you want that A? Why do you want the 4.0? Is it so that people will think so highly of you, so that you can advance yourself and get your career goals and your ambitions met and fulfilled? Or is it because this is a stewardship? And I love to give glory to God by taking what He's given me in terms of academic ability and mental facility and investing that for His glory. Is the enthroned God the center of my extracurriculars? Those of you who play athletics, do you give any thought to this? Does this factor into what you do and why you do it? When I was in high school, I played basketball and baseball, and I lived for baseball. I ate, slept, and dreamed of baseball. When I couldn't be outside playing baseball, I was inside the garage playing baseball. When I couldn't be inside the garage, I was inside playing, you know, baseball video games. This was my passion. This was my love. Unfortunately, I wasn't at the time being governed by God. And so for me, for example, in playing basketball, you know, the greatest thing would be to get a fast break, go down the lane, you know, put it down. The whole crowd just erupts, applause. You're awesome. You're the man. Where's God in that? So if you are going to score, score to the glory of God. If you're going to dunk, dunk to the glory of God. If you're going to wrestle, wrestle to the glory of God. But make sure that God is the centerpiece, the focal point of what you're doing and why you're doing it. As you're out there running around, you're thinking, God, you've given me this breath. You've given me the ability to lift these weights. You've given me the ability to score. And this is to your glory and to your credit. Is God at the center of your social media? There was a really good collegiate editorial that was written September 20th, 2013. The title is Facebook User Studies Report Less Happiness Reveal Selfish Motives. And the editorial says, it's not always how much time we spend on social media, though time is an important consideration, but how we are engaging with social media. We've all heard the cautionary tales about frittering hours away on Facebook, but the bigger question is why we are on there in the first place. Whoever wrote that nailed it on the head, in my estimation. Why are you on there in the first place, and what are you seeking to accomplish? What is on display? We as Christians, this person writes, has the unique opportunity to use social media platforms as a tool to build friendships, share news, to encourage one another, all the while spreading the gospel. Why don't, you know, we don't have to preach in every status we post, but we can use the small daily interactions we have online as chances to show the difference in our lives because of Christ's work for us and within us. There's also another trend to use Facebook and other social media sites as a way to present our best selves. Our profile pictures are perfect. We rarely post about our faults, and we manage our profiles in such a way that other people only see the things we want them to see or know. This isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it does merit caution. Are we trying to present ourselves as something we're not? Is what we say on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram the truth, or merely embellishments of what we wish our lives were like? Unless our lives are firmly grounded in Christ as our sole source of happiness, then our feelings will be easily swayed when seeing how other people live, what they drive, the food they eat, and how great they look. I mean, this selfishness is so pervasive that we have to be aware of it at all times. It can come through even in the, you know, in what we would call, you know, humble brags that you see as Facebook statuses. Like, you know, let's say after chapel I put on Facebook, you know, humbled to be able to preach to thousands of people at Bob Jones Chapel and to see such a wonderful response. Humbled. Grateful. Okay. You know, there are just these, we, you know, I'm always telling my kids, you know, to curb their selfishness because it's on display. And then I look in my own heart and I say, you know what, I'm just as selfish as they are. I'm just more sophisticated in my display of it. And what I want to come to the point where the arrangement of things in my life and in my heart corresponds to and mirrors the arrangement of things in heaven. Let me encourage you to go to Revelation chapter 4, and I want to raise and answer one question here that I think is really important. And that's the question, why does God get to be at the center? Why does God get to be at the center? Why is it wrong for me to be the focal point? And the answer to that question is found in chapter 4, verse 8, where John records that the four beasts, and each of them had six wings about them, and they were full of eyes within, and they rest not day and night, and listen to what they say. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, which was and is to come. Why does God get to be at the center? Because he alone is holy. He is unique. He's in a category all by himself. In what sense is he unique? He's all powerful. He's the Lord God Almighty. And there's no one that compares to his power. He is the Lord of Lords. And he is eternal. He is the one who was and is to come. He transcends time. He is from everlasting to everlasting. He is unique. He is holy. And therefore, he deserves to be at the center of my life and your life. And it's not just that. He is the creator of all things. Look at chapter 4, verse 11. Look at what the 24 elders say. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power. Why? Because thou hast created all things. And for thy pleasure, they are and were created. Every breath that I take right now is given to me by God. He created all things, including me. He's the hub. He's the center. He's the source of it all. Therefore, he deserves to be the focal point. But it's more than that. It's not just like, you know, yeah, God is the boss, and he gets to do whatever he wants to because he's all-powerful. What Revelation ends with, or Revelation 5 ends with, is a beautiful portrayal of another focal point. Look at it with me, chapter 5, verses 11 and 12. Yes, there is another focal point in heaven. Chapter 5, verse 11. And I beheld and heard the voice of many angels round about the throne and the beasts and the elders, and the number of them was 10,000 times 10,000 and thousands of thousands, saying with a loud voice, "Worthy is the Lamb that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom and strength and honor and glory and blessing." God is not distant as our creator. In fact, the God who created became one with his creation in the form of his Son, Jesus, in the person of his Son, Jesus. And he was slain for our sin, for our rebellion, for this selfishness. He lived a life of perfect obedience to the law and the governance of God. And then he offered himself up as a sacrifice for my sin. The Lamb was slain for you and for me. So there's no greater reason for us to give him our life, to make him preeminent in all things, to offer up to him continual praise and worship than this fact, that the holy, all-powerful, eternal God who created you and who has every right to condemn you because of your rebellion and my rebellion, that God died to redeem you. So it's no wonder that the vision of heaven ends like it does. Look at verse 13 of chapter 5. And every creature which is in heaven and on the earth and under the earth and such as are in the sea and all that are in them heard I saying, blessing and glory and power be unto him that sitteth on the throne and unto the Lamb forever and ever. And what will one day be the preoccupation of all creation in heaven ought to be the preoccupation and the orientation and the focal point of our lives today.